The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
So good morning and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning, wherever you are, that's where we are. So glad you could join us this morning. We are a Unitarian Universalist congregation. We are dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. We provide support and comfort, but also challenge and inspiration. I'm the Reverend Larry Pierce, minister at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and I want to give you a warm welcome today. Wherever you are in your life journey, wherever you are in your spiritual journey, whomever you love, whatever your gender, identity, or expression, we welcome you here to this ever-expanding circle of compassion, care, and justice. If you happen to be visiting us for the first time today, and you would like to, you'll notice that we have a virtual guest book that you can sign in on. There will be a link in the chat, and you could share your contact information with us if you'd like, so that we can send you news about our fellowship's activities and programs and so forth. So we'd love to hear from you and be able to connect with you. Our guest speaker today is Freedom Cartwright. Freedom is a healer, a systemic constellation facilitator, and the founder of Freedom Rail Tours, which I think you'll hear about in the sermon. Through her in-person and virtual interpretive tours to the cradle of the Confederacy in Montgomery, Alabama, she allows the voices of the silenced and the suppressed to be heard, received, and celebrated. Her deep desire is to embody and facilitate the celebration of Blackness and of the ancestors whose presence is palpable and essential in the healing of all seeming divisions between people, communities, and nations. You can find out more about her work, freedomrailtours.com after the service. Don't be looking now online, but you can do that later. So I actually have to say that Freedom, along with her husband Yule, who has joined us this morning, I see, I consider really dear friends. So I'm kind of excited to have you be here, Freedom, and to share some of your work and your message with us. I first got to know Yule and Freedom when I was a minister at First and Second Church in Boston in the late 80s, early 90s. Freedom, there is a collection of lunches and coffees and dinners that I think have knitted us together in a particular way. I certainly have vivid memories of when we talked so long in some restaurants that the wait staff would hover around us, you know, and try to give us a hint that it was time to move along. Or times when we laughed so long and so hard that I'm sure that we would be thrown out, but I pretended not even to notice, because the meal was really incidental. Sometimes you just have to be in life with someone, in all of its joys, all of its sorrows, its wonders, and its ponderings. And there are times when we've celebrated milestones together, celebrating each other's weddings, when we've celebrated the arrival of your children, and so forth. And I've been following your work in recent years, I should say, and I wanted so much for you to share it with this congregation. So Freedom, welcome. Welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I look forward to having you share your message. Thank you so much for being here. It's a joy for me.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah. So the opening words I have for you, I've written, are, beloved community is an already and a not yet. Beloved community is an already when we can recognize that we are already connected in a wondrous unity. And beloved community is already when we sense that we are beloved. And yet, beloved community is also a not yet. More and more, we cannot ignore the generational wounds in this country that seek to divide and dishonor people with Black bodies. More and more, we recognize that beloved community is not yet, as long as we continue to impose a caste system, putting human beings in categories and hierarchies that within our society or within our own minds limit possibility and potential. Yes, we know that beloved community is both a grace that already exists, and yes, we know that beloved community is an aspiration that requires perspiration for us to bring it about. May we join our hearts today in the blessing and the struggle and the challenge that the realization of beloved community will mean for us and for our world. So may it be. I'm going to ask Susan to light our chalice.
Good morning. Our chalice lighting this morning is adapted from Kimberly Ann Tomczak Carlson, A Place of Belonging and Caring. As I light our chalice this morning, let us acknowledge that each of us in our own way have been looking for something larger than ourselves. Inside each of us, there is a yearning, a calling, a hope for more. We have a desire for a place of belonging and caring. And so we seek a beloved community. We seek to be a community that does not put fences around love. We endeavor to become a community that holds its arms open to possibilities of love. We aim to be a heart home that nourishes souls. And now, Preston Littweiler will light our peace lamp.
And now I will light the peace lamp. Your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us. And with all the people of the world.
Our gathering song is a familiar African-American spiritual, Wade in the Water. The lyrics will appear on the screen and join in when you're ready. Let's gather together first in song and celebration.
Wade in the water, wade. Children wade in the water. God's a gonna trouble the water.
See that band all dressed in white.
God's a gonna trouble the water.
The leader looks like the Israelite.
God's a gonna trouble the water.
Ooh.
Wade in the water.
Oh,
wade in the water. Children, wade in the water.
God is gonna trouble.
God's a gonna trouble the water.
Oh, see that band all dressed in red.
God's a gonna trouble the water.
Ooh, it looks like the band that Moses led.
God's a gonna trouble the water.
Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa,
wade in the water.
Oh,
wade in the water. Ooh, children,
wade
in the water.
God is gonna trouble.
God's a gonna,
yes,
trouble.
He will.
God's a gonna trouble the water.
There's healing in the water.
God's a gonna, yeah, trouble, yeah, yeah, yeah. The water.
Deliverance in water.
God's gonna trouble the water.
My God is gonna trouble.
Gonna trouble the water.
So our reading this morning is entitled Before Rosa Parks, from Claudette Colvin, Twice Toward Justice, written by Philip Hoos. We all know the story of Rosa Parks, refused to give up her seat on the segregated Montgomery bus, which sparked a 381-day bus boycott. But most of us do not know that 9 months before Rosa Parks, a 15-year-old high school student named Claudette Colvin refused to move from her seat on the segregated Montgomery bus. Claudette's story and the stories of four other Black women who also refused to move from their seats on the segregated Montgomery bus are not often told. The following is an excerpt from the book, Claudette Colvin, Twice Toward Justice by Philip Hoos, in which Claudette shares her story in her own words. Claudette: one of the police officers said to the bus driver in a very angry tone, "Who is it?" The motorman pointed at me. I heard him say, "That's nothing new. I've had trouble with that thing before." He called me a thing. They came to me and stood over me, and one said, "Aren't you going to get up?" I said, "No, sir." He shouted, "Get up," again. I started crying, but I felt even more defiant. I kept saying over and over in my high-pitched voice, "It's my constitutional right to sit here as much as that lady. I paid my fare. It's my constitutional right." I knew I was talking back to a white policeman, but I had had enough. One cop grabbed one of my hands and his partner grabbed the other, and they pulled me straight up out of my seat. My books went flying everywhere, and I went limp as a baby. I was too smart to fight back. They started dragging me backwards off the bus. One of them kicked me. I might have scratched one of them because I had long nails, but I sure didn't want to fight back. I kept screaming over and over, "It's my constitutional right." I wasn't shouting anything profane. I never swore, not then, not ever. I was shouting out my rights. It just killed me to leave the bus. I hated to give that white woman my seat when so many Black people were standing. I was crying hard. The cops put me in the back of the police car and shut the door. They stood outside and talked to each other for a minute. And then one came back and told me to stick my hands out of the open window. He handcuffed me and then pulled the door open and jumped in the back seat with me. I put my knees together and crossed my hands over my lap and started praying. All ride long, they swore at me and ridiculed me. They took turns trying to guess my bra size. They called me the N-word bitch and cracked jokes about parts of my body. I recited the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm over and over in my head, trying to push back and the fear. I assumed they were taking me to juvenile court because I was only 15. I was thinking, now I'm going to be picking cotton. Since that's how they punished juveniles. They put you in a school out in the country where they made you do field work during the day. But we were going in the wrong direction. They kept telling me I was going to Atmore, the women's penitentiary. Instead, we pulled up to the police station and they led me inside. More cops looked up when we came in and started calling me thing and whore. They booked me and took my fingerprints. Then they put me back in the car and drove me to the city jail, the adult jail. Someone led me straight to a cell without giving me any chance to make a phone call. He opened the door and told me to get inside. He shut it hard behind me and turned the key. The lock fell into place with a heavy sound. It was the worst sound I ever heard. It sounded final. It said, I was trapped. When he went away, I looked around me, three bare walls, a toilet, and a cot. Then I fell down on my knees in the middle of the cell and started crying again. I didn't know if anyone knew where I was or what had happened to me. I had no idea how long I would be there. I cried and I put my hands together and I prayed like I had never prayed before. Meanwhile, schoolmates who had been on the bus had run home and telephoned Claudette's mother at the house where she worked as a maid. Girls went over and took care of the lady's three small children so that Claudette's mother could leave. Mary Ann Colvin called Claudette's pastor, the Reverend H.H. Johnson. He had a car, and together they sped to the police station. Claudette. When they led Mom back, there I was in a cell. I was crying hard. And Mom got upset too. When she saw me, she didn't bawl me out. She just asked, are you all right, Claudette? Reverend Johnson bailed me out and we drove home. By the time we got to King Hill, word had spread everywhere. All our neighbors came around and they were just squeezing me to death. I felt happy and proud. I had been talking about getting our rights ever since Jeremiah Reeves was arrested, and now they knew I was serious. Velma, QP, and Marianne's daughter, who was living with us at the time, kept saying it was my squeaky little voice that had saved me from getting beat up or raped by the cops. But I was afraid that night too. I had stood up to a white bus driver and two white cops. I had challenged the bus law. There had been lynchings and cross burnings for that kind of thing. Wetumpka Highway that led out of Montgomery ran right past our house. It would have been so easy for the Klan to come up the hill in the night. Dad sat up all night long with his shotgun. We all stayed up. The neighbors facing the highway kept watch. Probably nobody on King Hill slept that night, but worried or not, I felt proud. I had stood up for our rights. I had done something a lot of adults hadn't done. On the ride from home, from jail, coming over the viaduct, Reverend Johnson had said something to me I'll never forget. He was an adult who everyone respected, and his opinion meant a lot to me. Claudette, he said, I'm so proud of you. Everyone prays for freedom. We've all been praying and praying, but you're different. You want your answer the next morning. And I think you just brought the revolution to Montgomery.
Thank you, Larry. Oh, wow. So I'm going to offer us a little meditation, and then I'm going to allow you to contemplate some ideas. And at the end, there's going to be a couple of minutes of music, so you'll be able to just sit with some of the questions, some of the prompts that I've asked. So we're in a moment as a country, as a global community, and as a species where there is no safe place to stand. There's nowhere to hide that is beyond the reach of troubles. And I know I don't need to enumerate the crises that we are facing, and we're all aware of just how precarious our situation is collectively and individually. Dr. Cornel West, in his book, The Radical King, called such a time a 9/11 moment. We are in a 9/11 moment when all the usual stuff can't save us. And even the unusual stuff can't save us. On September 11th, 2001, planes crashed, towers collapsed, and people died. Folks trapped in the World Trade Center and folks on those planes recognized that time was precious, that these were the final crucial moments of their lives where they could make a difference, where they could say to that person that one more thing. And what they did was they called the people they cared about to offer love, to center love, to honor love as the most important shared experience of their lives. Dr. West calls that kind of love radical love. He says that radical love requires the cowardly self to die in order for the courageous self to live. This, our 9/11 moment, is a call for radical love. In whatever time we have, in the midst of uncertainty, of life and death consequences, we have the privilege of making a difference, of saying something meaningful and true, of taking courageous action, of centering love. If, as Dr. West goes on to say, these 9/11 moments are integral to what it is to be Black in America, then I want to spend the precious moments I have been given offering hope based on the radical love demonstrated by Black people who have faced and continue to face 9/11 moments and have so much to teach all of us. What better time than now to learn from a people who made a way out of no way and continue to do so? Black folks' history is the testimony of a people whose dreams for their children's children's children carried them through. The capacity to trust in what eyes could not see, as Harriet Tubman did, to have faith in the valley, as Sojourner Truth did, to take the next step, even when you can't see the whole staircase, as Dr. King did. These are exemplars of what radical love looks like in 9/11 moments. To receive the gifts of Black people's history is to know these stories and many, many more. So let's be grateful. We are not without mighty companions. And if we are still breathing, We must have a purpose to serve. We are needed. We are part of the movement forward. If you feel comfortable doing so, close your eyes, unless, of course, you're driving, and just notice your breath. Take a deep breath and let that breath relax your shoulders. Allow your chair or whatever you're sitting on, allow it to fully support you. If it feels comforting to do so, place your hand on your heart center and feel the rise and fall of your chest. I'm going to ask you three questions. I'm actually going to ask you the same question three times. And if you have something to write with, something nearby, and you want to take notes of your answer, that might be helpful. We might need this later. But otherwise, you can just remember. So here's the question. What are you grateful for? And you can explore that. Where do you feel gratitude? Where don't you feel gratitude? And question number two, again, what am I grateful for? Is it a person, or is it an experience? And as I contemplate that and sit with it, where in my body does that, where's the epicenter of that gratitude? Where is it arising? And let's go for number three. What am I grateful for? And perhaps you shift your hand to that place of that gratitude. Perhaps that gratitude is arising from your upper chest and neck area. Maybe it's in your belly. Maybe it's your head. You can just notice. So we're going to steep for a minute or two in gratitude. And let yourself just notice if it moves throughout your body, just following the gratitude. So we're going to play some music now. I started a tour company, Freedom Rail Tours, in 2019 by heeding a call from the ancestors to tell the stories of those whose voices were and are silenced and suppressed. So I bring folks to Montgomery, Alabama, the cradle of the Confederacy and the heart of Dixie, to bear witness to the legacy of genocide, slavery, lynching, segregation, and mass incarceration. The purpose of these journeys is to provide folks with space and time to feel their feelings about our history of slavery and to take an honest look at their internal conversation about racial differences. There's an African proverb that says, until the lion has its own storytellers, the tale of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. Today is the last day of Black History Month, and tomorrow marks the first day of Women's History Month. And I'll offer my opinion that to designate the stories of Black people and women each to just a month is no longer serving us. Black History Month and Women's History Month were created so that the lions and the lionesses could be their own storytellers. And we deserve to hear those stories, not just every month, but every day. So I'm taking you on a tour of Montgomery, and I'm sharing a couple of stories that are appropriate for Black History Month and Women's History Month. And because our time is limited, I'll be moving quickly through extraordinary events and introducing you very quickly to extraordinary people. So please let your curiosity get the better of you and take some notes about the people and places that you'd like to learn more about. Are you ready to go on a tour? So let's get started. And I neglected to say that I am presently where I am on Wampanoag land here on Martha's Vineyard, but I can't give any tour of anything in this country without first acknowledging the Native people. So people refer to slavery as America's original sin, but that's not true. The stealing of Native people's land under the guise of the doctrine of discovery and the genocide of Native people is the first sin. This map shows the relative areas of Native people's lands prior to the arrival of the Europeans. There were no less than 8 Native tribes that lived in what is now Alabama. The Montgomery area, where we're going to be spending time, was the home to several tribes of Native peoples, including the Alabama tribe, from which Alabama got its name, the Muscogee Creek tribe, and that includes the Abaca, the Coosa, and the Tallapoosa. And you'll be hearing Coosa and Tallapoosa again. Their numbers were decimated by disease and wars, and the Native peoples who remained were forcibly removed in the 1800s under President Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act, which made most of Alabama's Native peoples walk 1,200 miles to Oklahoma on what a Choctaw leader described as a trail of tears and death. So I'm taking you first to the riverfront. And here we are, we're in downtown Montgomery at the riverfront. And Montgomery was one of the biggest slave trading hubs in the antebellum South. The Alabama River, which is on the other side of that tunnel, the bottom of the screen, combined the Coosa River and the Tallapoosa River. So the Alabama River has 2 rivers that feed into it. And then there's a railroad, as you can see the railroad cars. And the river and the railroad provided the means for cotton to be shipped further south to Mobile, Alabama, and then on to mills overseas. The river and the railroad cars also served to bring enslaved human beings to Montgomery. After the transatlantic slave trade was abolished in 1808, enslaved people from the states of the Upper South, states such as Virginia, North Carolina, Maryland, and Kentucky, were being brought into the Deep South to meet the demands of the cotton industry. And slave breeding in the Upper South states kept the supply of human beings shipped to the Deep South going. So much so that this internal or domestic slave trade was called the Second Middle Passage. It's estimated that between 1790 and 1860, as many as 1 million enslaved people were relocated to the American South. And that tunnel at the bottom of the slide brought the enslaved people from the railroad cars and the steamboats to the slave auction block, which we will see later. The euphemism for slavery was commerce. And the street from the tunnel to the auction block is called, and to this day, it's called Commerce Street. And it said that there were more slave depots, places where slaves were held waiting for sale, than there were hotels in Montgomery. When we are together in body on tour in Montgomery, we sing Wading in the Water as we walk through that tunnel. Wade in the Water is a song with many meanings. One of them is that wading through water kept the dogs from tracking your scent if you were a runaway slave. And once you disembarked from the boat or the train, you are now in the Deep South, and it was very difficult to escape from the Deep South. Families were separated at the riverfront and marched through the center of town while townspeople ogled them and looking for their next field slave, house slave, mammy, seamstress, or cook. Slaves were also purchased for breeding. The proven reproductive capacity of enslaved women was an advertising selling point and a feature that increased their value. And this is relevant as we move on to a story about the Alabama Mothers of Gynecology. The Alabama Mothers of Gynecology, Anarka, Lucy, and Betsy, were enslaved women from plantations in and around Montgomery, Alabama. With neither consent nor anesthesia, they were experimented on by Dr. J. Marion Sims in the 1840s. His work was funded by plantation owners who wanted their enslaved women to have baby after baby. After publishing the results of his success, Dr. Sims moved to New York to seek fame and fortune. Within a decade, he became known as the father of gynecology. By contrast, Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy fell into anonymity. They changed the world only to be forgotten by it. Informed decision-making was not an option for enslaved women that J. Marion Sims experimented on. And Michelle Browder, who you see in the photo, is a social justice entrepreneur and local tour guide who also works with kids in underserved communities. She is trying to subvert the narrative that elevated Sims to be the father of gynecology. And alongside artists and activists, Michelle Browder recently unveiled plans to honor three women, Anarka, Lucy, and Betsy, who were subjected to Sims' exploitation. And Michelle Browder is standing at the state capitol in Montgomery, where the statue honoring Dr. Marion Sims stands. So today is Lucy, Betsy, and Anarka Day in Montgomery. And Michelle Browder, who we just saw, is memorializing them with a 15-foot public monument in downtown Montgomery, the goal of which is to tell these women's stories and shine a light on ongoing racial disparities in the healthcare industry. So that statue is going to be unveiled on Mother's Day, May 9th, of this year, 2021. But this is a special day because it's, you know, the Alabama Mothers of Gynecology Day, and they're having all kinds of amazing festivities in downtown Montgomery, social distanced, of course. They're having music and art and a walking tour, all to honor these three women whose names we know, and there were a total of 11 women who were experimented on by Dr. Marion Sims. And I'm wearing a t-shirt, actually. Let me show you my t-shirt. I'm wearing my Anarka Betsy and Lucy t-shirt honoring those women. So now I want to take you to the center of town. And I want to show you right in front here is a statue of Rosa Parks, who, as we all know the story, December 1st, 1955, refused to give up her seat on the segregated Montgomery bus. And her arrest sparked the Montgomery bus boycott and ushered in the next stage of the civil rights movement. And she has been called the mother of the civil rights movement. But there's so much more to the story of the bus boycott. As we know, having heard Larry do such an amazing job reading that account by Claudette of her arrest 9 months prior to Rosa Parks. So we're just gonna dive into some of the people, some of the women whose names we don't know behind the scenes. I wanna introduce you to the Women's Political Council, the WPC. And this was founded in 1946 after the League of Women Voters refused to integrate. So these women that you're seeing are or were educators. They were businesswomen. They were the pillars of the community. They were part of Montgomery's Black middle class. They were thought leaders. And they played a crucial role in building community engagement and activism during the bus boycott and during the civil rights movement. They are what we call the backbone of a community. I want you to meet one particular member of the WPC. This is Joanne Robinson. She moved to Montgomery in 1949 to teach English at Alabama State College. She was active in the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, which was the church where Dr. King was pastor. And she was also active in the Women's Political Council, becoming its president in 1950. So Joanne had a humiliating incident herself on the Montgomery bus. And she and the WPC made repeated complaints about seating practices and driver conduct to the Montgomery City Commission. Joanne said by doing basically talking to lots of people in the community, Joanne basically said that 3 out of 5 Black Montgomery residents had a horrible thing happen to them on the bus. And after the court decision of Brown versus Board of Education, which essentially said separate and equal is not constitutional. She told the mayor after that decision that a bus boycott might ensue. And if the bus did not improve, if they didn't improve what they were doing, there might be a boycott. So when Rosa Parks was arrested, Joanne said, okay, this is an opportunity to enact a boycott. And she, plus 2 students from Alabama State, and the chairman of the business department of Alabama State mimeographed and distributed 52,500 flyers calling for a boycott of the buses. For fear of losing her job, Joanne did not take a formal role with the Montgomery Improvement Association, which was the organization created to oversee the boycott. She was active behind the scenes. In her memoir called The Montgomery Bus Boycott and the Women Who Started It, she writes, "An oppressed but brave people whose pride and dignity rose to the occasion, conquered fear, and faced whatever perils had to be confronted. The boycott was the most beautiful memory that all of us who participated will carry to our final resting place. So the case that ended the attorneys Fred Gray and Charles Langford filed a case called Aurelia S. Browder versus William A. Gale on behalf of four Black women, Aurelia S. Browder, all the way on the left, Claudette Colvin, who you've met already, Mary Louise Smith, and Susie McDonald. And all four of these Black women had been mistreated on city buses in the year of 1955. The case made its way to the US Supreme Court, which upheld a district court ruling that the statutes of the state of Alabama and the city of Montgomery ordinances requiring segregation on Montgomery buses was unconstitutional. And that ruling by the Supreme Court is what brought about the end of the bus boycott. Each of these women have incredible stories, and I'm so sorry we only had time to tell one of them. I'm so glad we got to hear Claudette's story. I just want to say Aurelia S. Browder, the plaintiff named in the case, is an absolute powerhouse, extraordinary person. Maybe you'll be enticed to go look her up. So I have to bring you now to the last stop on our tour, significant place. It looks like a fountain, it is a fountain, but it's actually the location of the auction block at Court Square in the center of Montgomery, where Black people were sold as chattel, as property. And it is now a fountain, but it actually is an artesian well. So underneath the ground, it's an artesian well, which is a water source that bubbles up from the earth because of pressure from rocks. So this space right here, this place, has always been, from the time of the native peoples, a center, a gathering spot, a trading place, a communication place. And you can see in the distance the state capitol building. Now that's Dexter Avenue, you're looking straight up Dexter Avenue. And that's where the 1965 Voting Rights March, which started in Selma, ended. It ended right up there at that Capitol building with a speech by Dr. King in which he said, "How long will justice be crucified and truth buried? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment, however frustrating the hour, it will not be long, because truth crushed to earth will rise again. How long? Not long, because no lie can live forever. How long? Not long, because you shall reap what you sow. How long? Not long, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Dr. King's church, the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, is up the street on the right. So it's tucked in among these huge buildings with big columns and large edifices. And directly on our right is the Winter Building. So it's just on the right side of your screen. And that's the building where the telegram was sent to take Fort Sumter, which was the first act of the Civil War. Montgomery was actually the first location of the home of the Confederacy before it was moved to Virginia. Also directly across this fountain was the bus stop where Rosa Parks got on the bus. So this place, I think of it, my experience of this place is that it's an energy vortex. It's ground zero of our history of terror and cruelty. And it's also the birthplace of the civil rights struggle that continues until this very moment. So I asked you during our meditation, you know, what are you grateful for? And if you made notes, you can take a look at them. If not, you can just recall what you're grateful for. And recultivate that feeling of gratitude and thanks. And perhaps bring your hand back in touch with your heart center. And standing here at this powerful place, I want to leave you with another couple of questions to contemplate. One question is, what do I want to give my love and attention to? The second is, what is most important right now? So just breathe in and tune in, and let's just take about 30 seconds of quiet, of stillness right here at this special spot, just to sit with that. Thank you for coming on tour with me today, and thank you for your deep listening. Thank you to my dear friend and brother, Larry, for inviting me to speak today. And thank you to the TPUUF team behind the scenes who are keeping things going. I'm so grateful for this opportunity to share some stories, to be a conduit for voices of those who did not make the headlines. Peace, love, and blessings.
Thank you so much, Freedom.
Thank you.
Thanks for holding up those stories that otherwise we might not know. Thank you for allowing us to touch our own hearts and to recognize that whatever gratitude that we feel has been a gift, but it's a gift not to be contained, but to motivate and to move us to create opportunities for gratitude for others in a world that wants to be and is not quite yet a beloved community. Appreciate it. This is the time in our service when we attend to the matters of our heart, our individual hearts and our collective hearts. It's a time for us to first pause and to recognize whatever joy we might be holding or whatever concern we might have for ourselves or those we love, and to let them come to the surface so that we can hold them ever so briefly in our heart. It's also a time to share a gleaning, a short lingering insight or impact of the service or the sermon on you. Obviously, during this time of the service is not a time for discussion. It's really just a time to share briefly. Briefly means like a sentence, in case there was any doubt. There will be a time following the service for informal conversation. But let's now, during this musical interlude, pay attention to our heart, the joy, the concern, and the gleaning from the sermon. And if you care to share briefly with others, then there'll be an opportunity to do so. And then Mike will give us those instructions following this musical interlude.
This time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life. The words will show up here on the screen momentarily, and today we're going to use a different set of the audio than we're used to. So this will be sung by Amelia Wisniewski-Barker and Brittany Ann Tranberg.
Oh, I now invite you to sing with me, Spirit of Life.
Spirit of life, come unto me, sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion, blow in the shape of justice, roots hold me close, wings set me free. Spirit of life, come to me, come to me.
As I extinguish our chalice, please join with me as we read in unison these closing words by the Unitarian minister and avid abolitionist, Theodore Parker. The words will appear on your screen and are also in your order of service. Be ours, the religion, which is like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living. And now we will have our closing song, Amazing Grace, accompanied by Christine Perry and Isaac Strader.
We